All right, thank you everyone for being patient. We will go ahead and get started with the presentation today. So as you may know, having registered for this webinar, you are attending the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program focused on small liberal arts colleges. As a quick introduction, I want to give everyone a second to, you know, let them know that they are on the phone. My name is Sarah Causer. I am an outreach and recruitment analyst here at the Institute of International Education, where we have the pleasure of administering this program. I'm joined by my colleague in the D.C. office, Kaylee, if she'd like to say hello.
Hi, everyone. My name is Kaylee Smasniak. I'm a placement advisor at IIE. I work with researchers and scholars.
We are also joined online by a couple colleagues as well. Well, David Levin at the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs is on the line if you would like to say hello.
Hey, everybody. Nice to be with you, and thank you for tuning in.
And then we are also joined by some alumni of this program. We are lucky to actually have both the host institution and the scholar on this call from a previous small liberal arts college. Darla, would you like to say hello and introduce your scholar?
Hi, everyone. Pleasure to be with you today from Coastal Carolina University, and I'm delighted that we also have Mimouna Zitouni, who is our Fulbright Scholar in Residence from the University of Oran in Algeria, on the conference with us today.
And Mimouna, would you like to say hello real quick?
Yeah, thank you. Hello, everybody, and thank you for having me.
Great. Well, I know it's a lot of people on this call, but we will move through this information as fast as possible to really give our host institution the time to explain their experience, not only applying, but how they actually utilize this program on campus. So before we move forward, I just want to highlight a few other things about this program and about the system. On the system, there is a question and answer portion at the end. You can submit questions throughout the presentation. And we will get to those at the end. So just please utilize that box throughout the presentation. We'll make sure that while we're not speaking, all the panelists on the phone will be muted. That way you can hear everyone clearly. And lastly, this session is being recorded. So if you want to hear it again, it will be live within about 3 to 5 business days, and we'll send that out to everyone. So moving right on ahead. Today, we will be providing an overview of what the Fulbright Scholar in Residence program is. We'll go over the application components, tools, and resources available to you as institutions. I apologize for this slide. It is incorrect. But we have an institutional profile, and I'll change this when we send it out, for Coastal Carolina University. And that's the time for both Darla and Mimouna to really talk about their experience, which is really kind of the heart of this presentation today. After that, we'll touch on a few other opportunities that your institution might be interested in, and we will wrap it up with that question and answer section. So, like every presentation, we always start out with this general Fulbright program slide. It's really just to let you know who the program is and what we're really seeking to do. The Fulbright program was established in 1946 by a junior senator named J. William Fulbright. His goal was really to strengthen the relationships between the people of the United States and the rest of the world. This program is sponsored by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, and it is administered by the Institute of International Education. And we've been very excited to be working with the Department of State for the last 72 years of this program. Just to really drive home the point, this is really a prestigious academic exchange program. We've seen so many benefits, and I know Darla and Mimouna will really discuss that. But really, the goal of this program is to serve as a public diplomacy initiative within the Department of State. So we just like to make sure that everyone is aware of that. Moving on, the Scholar in Residence program allows U.S. institutions to apply to bring scholars and professionals from abroad to their campuses for either a semester or a full academic year. These scholars actually are teaching primarily undergraduate courses during that time, so you actually put together a proposal requesting what you would like them to do during this semester or full academic year. They can be teaching courses, and we'll get into this a little bit more. They can be teaching courses that you already offer but adding an international perspective, or they can be helping to design new courses that you have not offered before. Really, the goal of this program is to engage with institutions underrepresented within Fulbright, So as you are aware, you're coming hopefully from a small liberal arts college. You are really a key demographic that we're trying to reach. So this is why we have this special webinar for you, to really say, you are who we want. We want to see more applications. This is really a goal of our program. Kaylee will get into a little bit more about the program and how to go about it, but you can either name the scholar or ask us to recruit a scholar for you. So there's two different routes to go. Kaylee will touch on that a bit more. The last two points I want to drive home is the deadline is October 15th, but something that makes this program really special is the fact that we do allow you to submit draft proposals up until October 1st. Mostly Kaylee, and I will be working on reviewing these and providing some good key feedback to help you bolster and make these applications better. And Kaylee will discuss that a bit more. But that's something that you don't get on other Fulbright programs, so it's something that we really find special about this. Throughout the presentation, we'll talk about ways to contact us. Email is the best method. Kaylee and I are both on the email, so far@iie.org is a great way to get in touch with us. So with that, I'm actually going to pass the line over to David Ludden to talk about the program benefits that he has seen through the Department of State with this program. David?
Sarah, thank you very much. Yes, I think SIR, in fact, is unique among Fulbrights. You know, for those of you who are familiar with the program, in general, you typically think of Fulbright as an individual grant opportunity for a student, for a scholar, for a teacher, going overseas or coming to the United States. SIR is one of a small number of programs that's actually institutionally driven. So the application is coming from you as an institution. You're bringing a scholar to your campus for a semester of an academic year. And in sum, I would say the idea is to engage with your scholar in a whole variety of ways that will help you internationalize your campus and your community. You know, as Sarah said, they're teaching courses, they're engaged across campus beyond the classroom that they're teaching in, but interacting with students and faculty and administrators in a whole variety of ways, and they're also engaged with the surrounding community. So it's really a blueprint, in a sense, that you design, which is your application, describing what you would intend for your scholar to do, whether you're actually getting a scholar by name or whether you're asking us to recruit for you. And I think our experience has been, because of the efforts that you put into this in the front end, the planning stage of this, the design of the proposal, the kinds of things that you want your scholar to do, and Donna can talk a bit about that in terms of what they've done in Coastal Carolina, it's really a win-win situation. You've designed a blueprint, in the sense of activities for the scholar. The scholar has a ready-made universe and a set of activities to which to engage, and it's just a tremendous benefit both for the campus and for the scholar as well.
Great. Thanks so much, David, for that insight. And we will be bringing Dave in throughout this presentation to really showcase that Department of State insight and give you kind of a sneak peek into the program. So moving on ahead, there we go. As I mentioned, one of the key demographics, and as David mentioned, that we're really trying to engage with in terms of institutions are small liberal arts colleges. You can also see the full list of institutions that we hope to engage with this program on the screen. So this ranges from those minority-serving institutions to community colleges to the small liberal arts and rural colleges and universities. Now, if you are not coming from a small liberal arts background, we're still happy to have you on the line. We are not trying to exclude you from this program, but we may ask you to consider, if this is a program for you, to maybe consider partnering with an institution in the area. So we're not in the business of trying to exclude people from these programs, but we really want to make sure that we're reaching kind of the key populations that we're trying to engage with. On the screen, we do include this pie chart to really drive home, you know, the fact that a large chunk of SIR grants between 2010 to 2016 really did come from small liberal arts. That's the nice 26% purple area that you can see on the screen. David, did you have any other kind of insights about what you have seen in terms of trends from, let's say, 2010 moving to today?
I think that small liberal arts colleges have typically done very well in the competition, and in a sense, I think the program really fits so well with a small liberal arts college because of the fact that you typically are doing things on campus in a collaborative way, so it's not that difficult to form a committee, for example, a group to design a proposal and determine how you're going to utilize a scholar. And, you know, the fact that it's typically a smaller campus means it's easy for the scholar to get around campus and to meet lots of people. So I think it really is in a sense, sort of tailor-made a match between a small liberal arts college and the SIR program itself.
Great. Thank you so much, David. And to really piggyback off of what he was saying, we have included a list of the previous small liberal arts colleges that participated in this past academic, or current, I guess I should say, academic year. And there are listed 22 colleges. So this is really to say, like, these are, you know, your colleagues at other campuses to say they have been doing this and to really encourage you to consider this opportunity. So with that, I am actually going to pass over the microphone to Kaylee to really dive into the application components of what you will experience if you do apply.
Thanks, Sarah. So yes, as she had mentioned, both her and I are in the SIR inbox. You'll be hearing from us as we're nearing the deadline especially, and if you do submit those draft proposals, which we encourage you to do really as soon as possible, then we'll be happy to be working with you via email or on the phone as needed. But okay, to dive in, we have the application itself is housed online through a system called Embark. Since we really want to focus today's session around hearing from Coastal Carolina, I'll run a little bit more quickly through a few of these sections, but as a quick note about the webinars, if you want a more in-depth look at the application components, then take a look at a webinar that we held in the first week of April, the recording of which should be uploaded to our website soon. We'll have more application-facing webinars in May, and then in early fall we'll be having webinars that almost act as office hours where you and anyone else can log in and hear what other questions people might be having as they're completing the application, and you can ask some questions yourself. So you'll see once you log into Embark upon starting an application that first you have a shorter application form in which you'll enter text or use drop-downs, followed by sections in which you'll upload a number of documents. So what we always like to say is that it's helpful for institutions to just get into the system and just open an application early just to gain insight into what's being asked of them and to get a sense of the overall components. I'd also encourage you to take a look at the Scholar in Residence Guidelines published on our website and that Sarah will link to later, which will be clickable when it's uploaded to our website. And those guidelines provide a more in-depth look at what the different components of the application form are and the narrative proposal entail. For this first section of the application, though, you'll see on the screen the individual components. It's a more basic section, so you'll mostly be writing in names and contact information in the text boxes. I do want to highlight a few pieces quickly. So you'll see that there are two contacts that you'll be listing in this section. One is for the administrative official or anyone who can sign off on affiliation information. And then the other would be the principal contact for academic arrangements. So for both of these contacts, we know that it can vary widely between universities, colleges, community colleges, small liberal arts, and everything. So we really do defer to you and as to who the appropriate individual is at your own campus. For program dates, we are working pretty far in advance, so you should be listing dates in the section for the 2019-2020 academic year. We will be discussing financial support and those named versus recruited scholars that Sarah had mentioned previously, so we'll discuss that soon. but you would list the basic information in this application form section. And then lastly, there's a proposal summary with a limit of 700 characters. This is a required field, and it is very, very helpful. It gives our reviewers a snapshot of what you're proposing, so you can highlight all major proposal pieces right here for us to see right off the bat. Okay, so now we're getting into the next section, which is called the narrative. These are all of those uploads that I had mentioned. So this is really the main essence of the application, and it's divided into two parts. So the first part is the institutional profile. It's 4 to 5 pages, or 7 to 8 if you are interested in a joint proposal, since you're doubling the institutions that you're applying with. So for this, just keep in mind that reviewers may or may not know your institution and your college, so this section really is key to giving them a better idea of what you're all about. So things you'll include in this institutional profile include the general institutional information as listed on the screen here. We find that it's often helpful to break down these 4 to 5 pages by section, so by these bullets or points that we have listed here. So you would slot in a few paragraphs under the mission heading and then the academic offerings heading and so on down the line, just to help make it a little bit more palatable for you and also for the reviewers down the line. But again, that's not a hard and fast formatting rule, just a tip. So what we mainly want to see in this section is how your institution is set up, what you have in place, and alternately what you might not have in place that an SIR could possibly help with or complement. This section is also where you'd indicate your institution's short and long-term goals and objectives. So what are you hoping to gain, generally speaking, through internationalizing your campus and efforts? And then how specifically would hosting a scholar in residence fit these short and long-term goals? So David, I wanted to throw it over to you from Department of State perspective and see if you have anything to add about this first part of the narrative proposal.
No, I think we've outlined it in a way we hope it's both useful and works well for you in terms of answering the kinds of questions that Kelly's talked about. I think it is good to be concise, but to think through, what are you doing internationally, and what would the scholar in residence add to that effort? And one of the questions we get occasionally is, we're not new to this field. We've done a variety of things. Is this hour still relevant for us? And we would say that yes, it certainly works for both institutions that has not done a lot, perhaps, and would like to have an SIR help them to ramp up their efforts. But even if you've got a range of things in place already, that's fine. And tell us how the SIR might take you to a different level, might bring in another perspective, maybe a different world region than what you've been focusing on, that lets you augment what you've got in place. So this can be for the institution that is relatively new to this field, as well as an institution that has a fair amount of experience but wants to take it to another level.
Great, thank you, David. Okay, so the next section that we have is the narrative proposal part 2. So this is where you show what the Scholar in Residence program is going to accomplish for you and for your institution. So Darla, just to give you a heads up, after I run through a few pieces in this section, I might hand this over to you to discuss your approach and any learning experiences that you, or any suggestions that you might have for potential applicants.
Okay.
Thanks. Within the oversight section, you are addressing who on campus will be responsible and for what during the entirety of the visit. So you would already have identified 2 contacts in that first part of the application form I mentioned, so the administrative official and the faculty associate. So you'd use this oversight section to just give a little background of those individuals and what they'll be doing with the scholar on campus. We have seen this oversight section take a few different shapes and forms. So there could just be a few faculty listed here, but there could also be a whole Fulbright steering committee that engages staff from different college departments or backgrounds. We heard from a community college on Monday that used the steering committee technique. So I'd encourage you to take a look at that presentation if you're interested. And the oversight section, again, is really all dependent on your specific college or university. So what we want to see is what thought you've put into the scholars program on campus and to make sure that you and the scholar will be set up for success. Then we have the academic program of the scholar. So here you would talk about qualifications or background of a scholar that would meet a proposal's needs. And then also to delve into the need for the courses themselves. So we do often get a question about how many courses a scholar might teach on campus. And we do see on average about 2 per semester. As Sarah has said, sometimes a scholar might be teaching a pre-designed course that has been offered in the past and providing an international perspective. But other times they might be creating entirely new courses, or they might be giving a lecture series. So just highlighting all of those different pieces here is really important so that the reviewers understand the amount of preparation that's going to be needed to actually complete these activities, so speaking to project feasibility. Also be sure to discuss how the scholar in residence will interact all across campus and even across the community. So this should show that you've thought through how to maximize the scholar's time and presence in your whole community. So we've mentioned in terms of professional enrichment that, yes, this application is institutionally driven, but we do want to see where there's potential for the scholar's individual growth. So if you were to include the scholar in faculty meetings, orientations, or having them attend any academic conferences, then you'd indicate that here. And then for sustainability, just focusing on how you would sustain the scholars' activities after they leave. David, would you like to mention a few creative ways that you've seen hosts maximize SIR's time in the past?
Sure. So we've had a variety of things put in place, everything from having your scholar continue with you in a teaching capacity, perhaps online. We've seen examples of student and faculty exchange between your school and your scholar's home school, which could be in a small scale or even a larger scale where you might even sign an MOU between the two institutions. We've seen cases where a scholar who was in economics actually went home and set up a relationship between businesses in his home community and his host community. So there's various ways that you could think about utilizing your scholar and the benefits that your scholar has brought to your campus to sustain some of these efforts, after your scholar has gone home, and certainly cases where the scholar introduced a course into the curriculum and that was then sustained after the scholar went home. So there's a variety of possibilities for you to continue the benefits of an SIR even after your scholar returns home.
Okay, thank you, David. And then for financial support, our last point on here, you will take the amounts that you had provided on that first section, the application form, and expand on them here. Cost share is encouraged, and institutions are asked to think creatively of ways that they can provide this, but this is certainly not required, and it won't make or break an application. You won't be disqualified if you can't provide financial support. It could take the form of salary supplement or an in-kind support. So we've seen institutions who have offered meal plans on campus, provide or defray the cost of housing, provide public transportation access, audit classes. So you just be providing estimates at what you think those, or what you know those in-kind supports are valued at, and provide that insight into this section. And then David, just to get your perspective on this section as well.
Sure. So as Kaylee said, this is not an essential requirement. We're encouraging it. If you can do this, that's great. We understand that colleges are sort of all different levels in terms of your capacity to do that, whether it's cash or whether it's in kind. But I think Kaylee had some good examples of resources that schools have made available to the scholar. We've also had examples where if the scholar brought a dependent, the dependent might be enrolled in courses either on campus or maybe in the school district. We've seen things like English language offerings for dependents. There's a range of things that you might think as feasible and doable in terms of your contribution to your scholar. And I guess I would say in terms of cash, just to show you the sort of the variance, in a given year we've seen everything from $0 to $50,000 as an actual cost share. So we're not saying you all need to do $50,000. We understand that's was an extraordinary circumstance. But the point is that there's a wide variety, and we're happy to work with you in whatever your situation may be.
Perfect. Thank you, David, for that background. And then Darla, we also wanted to hear from you from a host perspective about what this section of the application looked like for you and if you're able to speak to any sustainability measures.
Right. Well, first off, I think what I would echo all that you said. I think it is extremely important to have a plan and to be very intentional up front. Just to give some construct to this for us, we had introduced a new intelligence and national security studies major on our campus. It accelerated very, very rapidly in terms of student enrollment. And we knew that we needed to add Arabic, but like many institutions, to get a line, a position for that was a challenge. And so we identified strategically the direction we wanted to go. And in the short term, we needed someone who could develop and offer the courses so that we could demonstrate that, in fact, there was strong demand so that we could then sustain it through line items in our future years. And so I would say that in this first part about the oversight, for us it was really a conversation including our Center for Global Engagement, our AGEP, which is our Arts and Humanities Global Experience Program, our Department of Language and Intercultural Studies, our College of Humanities and Fine Arts more broadly, our Global Studies area, and everybody sort of got together, although I really need to give kudos to Tripti Pillai who led that effort for us. And so I think being very intentional and then listening to where the benefits of that scholar coming can be very helpful to the strategic internationalization wherever you're at was really important. So as an example, in terms of community outreach, we have a Fulbright Council on our campus that Muna was introduced to in the very first month she was there. She ultimately participated as a major contributor to our Fulbright Forum that we held that helped to advance Fulbright initiatives as well as a broader understanding of Algidia as a part of that process. And beginning on May 3rd, she'll be teaching Arabic and North African cultures to a local middle school that has a shortage of language, the ability to deliver those programs, and is very important to them. So I think the intentionality of it is really important, and I would encourage a really broad dialogue of involving every area you can think about who might participate in it. That will help to craft a clearer statement of the campus activities. And quite honestly, it also helps to narrow down the laundry list you might create up front to be very focused on both your mission benefit and how it serves the mission of the institution and the directionality of your internationalization wherever you're at. But also it will generate very important conversations about how do we support this scholar who's giving a year of their life to this effort for our campus and community enrichment as well. And I think that led to some real conversations up front about professional development funds, conference funding, research materials, and so forth, that were very, very helpful for us to have as a community and come to agreement on to be able to meet the parameters not only of the proposal and get it into succinct format, but also to be absolutely assured that we could deliver on it. With respect to financial support, I will say that we had developed an international visiting lecturer program. And for the liberal arts institutions on the line, I would encourage you to think about, if you don't have already something like this, think about how your adjunct faculty models work and see if you can bundle a few of those, whatever those cost parameters are, in terms of matches. And that was a starting point for us that ultimately got expanded even further. And finally, with respect to sustainability, the courses that MUNA has both created and offered will remain very critical parts, thank you, MUNA, to our campus community. This collaboration at the middle school level is what's really exciting, is that it's empowering that principal to go back and say, here are some creative ideas about how I have in mind to be able to expand access to students in what is a very largely rural area around us. And furthermore, it also prompted a language and intercultural studies framework for our schools that I think we're going to see some excitement down the road. And finally, we have expanded that to then look into the FLTA, the Foreign Language Teaching Assistant Program, as well. So I think this, in terms of sustainability, has a number of things that are very important. And I don't want to leave out MUNA, and we've already identified six areas of cooperation, and we have still, before MUNA leaves our campus, to narrow some of those down to concrete actions that will happen, and ultimately an MOU as well. So apologies for the lengthy response, but I think those are some areas that speak to just maybe things that are helpful to you as you're developing your application.
No, that's perfect. Thank you so much, Darla, for all of that insight. I mean, that's what we want now, the insight from your perspective as a host. And just to let everyone on the line know, we will be talking about letters of support in a few moments. So how she was talking about that community engagement piece and getting the scholar involved right away, we'll talk about that. And then also, how Darla was talking about the intentionality as you're actually writing the proposal, agreed that you just really want to make sure that all of the pieces of this application are cohesive and that they all serve to just strengthen the larger application. I know that it can be tricky to think in terms of a specific scholar when you're asking for a recruited scholar. So we'll actually go into the next section now, which is talking about after the narrative portion, we'll want to actually hear more from you about the scholar that you wish to bring. So you'll see that the program allows for two different tracks, either naming a scholar or asking for recruitment of a scholar. And again, Darla, I will be throwing this over to you in a moment after I run through these options briefly, if that's all right.
Sure.
Okay, so for naming a scholar, you can actually name a scholar in your proposal that perhaps a faculty member has worked with in the past or that you have had connections with or interaction with in the past. So if you do name a scholar, we ask that you outline why that particular scholar best fits your particular proposal, because as we've been saying, this is an institutional application, so you're basing your application around the needs of your specific institution. If you name a scholar, we ask that you submit a CV and two letters of recommendation. One of those letters should speak to the scholar's teaching ability, since they're coming to your campus to primarily undertake teaching activities. And then you'll also want to be sure that they have the required English skills to teach that topic on campus. So this is where you'd list any needs along those lines. So if you don't have a specific scholar in mind or really have those connections in place, that's no problem. You can request recruitment of a scholar. So if you go this route, then you'd be able to choose two different countries within one world region. These are all listed on our website. And just a note, if you don't see a country of interest on the website, just reach out to us at sir@iie.org. We'll run through options with you and discuss and see what we can do. But in the proposal, you'd include information about the type of scholar that you'd want us to recruit. So we use any details that you give in this section to reach out to our colleagues abroad to see if they'll be able to recruit a scholar within a specific discipline or specialization that you're requesting. So it's important for you to outline any credentials that a scholar should have or a certain amount of teaching experience, degree requirements, anything really that can help us to narrow down those recruitment efforts. So we do often get questions about if it's better to name either or to either name or request recruitment of a scholar. So first, David, would you mind providing insight on that?
Sure. I think typically, as of late, we've had more proposals coming in where they've actually named a given scholar, but in terms of your individual application, it's really up to you. It doesn't make a difference to us at all in terms of whether you're requesting a scholar by name or whether you're asking us to recruit. We're perfectly happy to recruit for you if you don't have a specific scholar in mind. Bear in mind that if that's the case, that you probably would need to be a little more general in your proposal in terms of what you'd want that scholar to do. Also, if you're thinking about looking at scholars from two different countries in the region, which we recommend, please make sure that your proposal, in fact, is talking about both countries and not one country over the other. But our Fulbright commissions and U.S. embassies abroad are very happy to recruit for you if that's the case that you'd like some recruitment done, and we've certainly seen success in either track.
Great. Thank you, David. And then, Darla, would you mind talking about your institution's approach to this?
Yeah, so I would say this is one area where that broader collective of incorporating people from around your campus is super important, including for us it was both our human resources office as well as our accreditation sector, because we needed to make sure that everything up front was being asked for that would actually be needed to be able to ultimately hire Muna to be able to teach on campus. And that conversation was very time-saving and very critical to making sure that within days of her arrival on campus, things were in order, right? And of course, some things have to wait till they're there. So I would say make sure that you're including the colleagues who will be processing paperwork for them on your campus. And I'm assuming it would be in a employment capacity. And bringing those things into the narrative. Of course, your accreditation guidelines, if you have disciplinary accreditation, they may also add additional layers of what you have to have or can have, but then you also have to have due diligence in other ways. And I think just being very, very inclusive in that setting up front so that everyone can say, yes, if they have these things, we're good to go, is really important.
That's great. Thank you so much, Darla. And we actually had received a few questions before the webinar started about visa. So just a note about that is that since you're talking about some of those internal processes, well, IIE actually provides visa issuance and monitoring of the scholars coming in. So that's a piece that you wouldn't have to worry about. Okay. Thank you so much. So now we will shift forward to these remaining supplemental materials. So we had alluded to the letters of support earlier. These letters would directly relate to your institution and what you're applying to do. So at minimum, a letter of support, the one included, should be from the administrative official just to show that, yes, they're prepared to welcome the scholar on campus. There is no maximum to the number of letters you can upload here. You can seek out letters from different departments across your institution or neighboring institutions in the community, Rotary clubs or high schools in the area that the scholar might be involved with. So really anything to show that there is that enthusiasm on campus and in the community to say, yes, we will work with a scholar in residence and we're ready to get everything in place. Including a letter here doesn't mean that you're bound to work with these specific institutions or entities that provided letters for you. So you can either add letters down the line or add potential affiliations later down the line, and vice versa. And then lastly, we have the sample syllabi and the course outline. So these give a sense as to what the course or courses are about. So if you're naming a specific scholar, now would be a chance where you can provide insight into how that scholar would be able to teach and craft the syllabi and how this course would enhance your application overall and use a cultural perspective from a potential scholar in residence. Okay. So once you actually move forward with the application and you click that submit button, you might be curious as to what the external review community is looking for during their review. So as we've said, just really ensure that all of these pieces of the application are working together just to give the reviewers an overall picture of what you're trying to accomplish. So we have that first application form section and then those uploaded materials just working in concert to say, this is what we're about, this is what we need from a scholar in residence. Again, those short-term and long-term goals, you'd be, the reviewers are looking at those and to see how hosting a scholar in residence would contribute to meeting these goals of the proposal. So we had already discussed most of these when running through the application components. So just to look at a few pieces, you'll want to think through proposal feasibility within the time period, and then really expanding as much as possible on the types of community outreach and engagement and crafting a network across the institution. So I think that when we hear from Darla and Amuna in a few moments, we might be able to see some of the pieces of this review criteria in action.
All right. So before we do get to Darla and Mamona, we have two more slides that I will kind of run through just for your knowledge. On the screen right now, you can see the timeline for the SIR program. This is on the website as well. But as we said, you know, draft proposals are due on October 1st if you want some feedback from our staff. However, the entire application is due on October 15th. After that happens, our staff actually conducts a technical review. We will review it for completeness. If there's anything missing, we will get in touch with you. We are not looking to eliminate people at this stage. We want to give you every opportunity to actually submit missing pieces or pieces that might have cut off. Once we are done with that, there is a December external review committee. These are made up, in some cases, of previous SIR hosts as well as other people who have volunteered to serve on these committees. They will review each of the applications and determine whether or not which applications will move forward. After that, in January, you as the institutions will be notified of that review outcome. At the same time, the applications have gone to the Bureau of Educational and Cultural Affairs, ECA, the J. William Fulbright Foreign Scholarship Board, which we often call FFSB, it's a mouthful, and again, in concert, IIE is actually working on confirming that institutional funding, so there's a lot of moving pieces happening between January to February and so on. Anywhere in that time, just depending on which countries, these scholars are confirmed or recruited. So we'll be confirming the scholars if you name them, or the posts and commissions overseas, as David mentioned, will be working on recruiting the scholars using the parameters that you have set forth in your application. The host campuses at that time will also review any of those nominations that they have recruited. You'll make that final selection and we will move forward. From April to June, the grant packets are sent to the grantees, and then they are on your campus, either starting that fall or the spring, depending on which semester you have requested. But what we really want to drive home is the fact that do not forget that this deadline is October 15th, and do not forget this program offers that wonderful experience of submitting a draft proposal by October 1st. And we'll thank you even more if you submit it earlier. That way Kaylee's not inundated on October 1 with lots of applications, but we do look forward to receiving your applications, and we want to help you do well on this. The last piece that I have, and then I'm going to turn the microphone over, is application resources. Kaylee mentioned a few of these. We do have our webpage, which is cies.org/FAR. On that, you can actually access all of these, but we will be sending out these notes with the recording as well. So you can get to the application through that MBARC system from our website. You can access the application guidelines, which are very helpful and will answer actually any question you might have about the application or things you need. We will be having webinars ongoing, as Kaylee mentioned, throughout the open competition. I've already talked about the draft proposal. Please highlight it. It's a wonderful option that this program does offer. And we also have institutional and scholar stories. So while Darla and Ramona's stories will be wonderful to hear, if you need to hear more to really just encourage you as to why you should apply for this program, please check that out online. We also have a My Fulbright section, so if you do wish to, for you or anyone else on your campus, if they actually wish to apply for a regular core Fulbright to go overseas, that is a section where they can indicate it there. So many opportunities within the Fulbright family. And with that, we are going to pass the microphone over to Darla and Mimona. So please take it away, Darla, about your experience.
Well, first off, again, I just want to say thank you to the team there at the SIR program and the Department of State. This is an amazing resource that is available to our universities and colleges throughout the country. I think for us, this partnership up front was really important. There was a very clear tie to our campus internationalization plan. And like many institutions, we were trying to figure out how do we get some things done for which there wasn't a pile of resources sitting there available at the institution. For us, Arabic language, bringing it online meant, from an accreditation standpoint, somebody teaching it who already had the criteria to do so, but to develop it, you had to have somebody who had the criteria and the credentials to do so. So I think it's helpful to think like three steps down from where you are and envision this program as a resource to be helpful. For us, the resources that and the interface with the CIES and the SIR team was absolutely critical. A lot of back and forth and questions, so I encourage everyone to reach out and take advantage of the opportunity to get that feedback. And I think that for us, there were some confusing things as well. And I think, that was worked out as we both with the team there as well as once we saw bringing things onto our campus. I think one of the things that was that can be a little bit confusing is that when the scholar arrives on your campus successfully, there is some paperwork that they need to be able to do with SIR and a variety of organizations. So there needs to be time for them to get that done in the manner that brings out the activities and the files and documents that they need. And I'm glad to see you can see some of the photos. The bottom left photo, by the way, is Muna at the Fulbright Forum. Some of the others are her teaching and involvement in her OLF activities at other institutions as well while she has been at Coastal. I think some of the other things, be very thoughtful on your campus about family members who are coming as a part of that team with the scholar. It does bear some thought to think about how you'll effectively integrate those colleagues on your campus and introduce them to a network that they can find fulfilling as well. And I think for us, the only other thing that we kind of worked through, and Muna, I thank you for your patience with this, We weren't aware that Fulbright was quoting its stipend to the scholar in post-tax dollars, and we were quoting our support in pre-tax. So I think that's just something to be aware of and understand that it may be a point of clarity and communication in the process. But other than that, I can say that as you conceptualize what you intend for the scholar to contribute, I would encourage you not to try to schedule them to the max. There is, it's important that they have time to seek out and interface in organic ways on your campus and community. And Muna has brought great benefit to our broader community because of that. So I'm very grateful. And I think that her willingness to be involved with students, I think she has students who will happily follow her anywhere. She has made them aware of and confident in interacting in Arabic and able to and willing to engage in music and other areas. That's really pretty phenomenal in just this short a period of time. Her interest, and we have reached out, she spoke at Rotary Clubs for our Osher Lifelong Learning program for on our campus. And as I said, she's about to begin teaching a four-week set of seminars to students at what formerly was a Title I and just switched away from a Title I middle school. So for us, having Muna on campus has been not just professionally an exceptionally rewarding thing for our campus community, but also a way for people to understand more about the culture that she comes from, as well as the cultures of Northern Africa more broadly. And I will also say that Muna has become a dear, dear friend to me and to my family personally. And I can't imagine not having her nearby on a daily basis. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to Muna.
Wow, Dabla. thank you guys for this wonderful presentation. And I think my experience in Coastal Carolina University is an academic one par excellence, but at the same time has more of a cross-cultural international perspective. In fact, I started in Coastal Carolina University teaching two main courses, the Arabic language and culture course, and also literature across culture with a social linguistic perspective. But through my teaching experience, I have also been able to act as a visiting guest to classes in Coastal Carolina University, including politics classes, global studies classes, literature classes, and also I acted as a guest speaker in a number of film projections and debates and conferences. In addition to that, I have traveled, thanks to the outreach Fulbright program, to two main universities, Appalachian University and Bluefield State College University, where I met scholars, students, I participated in conferences and debates about different topics, including language, culture, tradition, North Africa politics, media, and so on and so forth. And also, I had the, let's say, the honor to start a MOOC. We signed a MOOC in Bluefield State College with the University of Oran, which will enable students from both universities to meet and exchange. So this is a wonderful thing that I think I achieved thanks to the Fulbright Outreach Program and also to people from Bluefield State College. In addition to that, together with Dalla, we are working on a MOOC between University of Oran and Coastal Carolina University on the same, we are on the same path. My experience is very cultural in the sense that I brought my culture and the United States also gave me culture in the sense that Dalla and Tripti and many people from Coastal Carolina showed me how the U.S. culture is manifested through the parties that I attended, through many invitations I received from Dalla and many other scholars here. So I feel that I am someone who is very lucky to go through the Fulbright program, and I wish when I came back to my country, I will act not only as the cultural ambassador of Algeria, but also share some of my insight about the culture in the United States.
All right, great. Thank you so much to you both for that background. It's just so helpful, I think, for all of the participants in this webinar to hear from you directly about what you accomplished and your relationship even, and the sustainability elements that you're mentioning, especially Mamouna, with the MOUs and the cultural ambassador component, of course.
Right.
So I know that Sarah might have a few more pieces to say. We also want to make sure that David has a moment to mention anything that he may want to chime in on before the end of the webinar. David.
I guess one of the questions that comes up frequently is people ask us, should I apply for an SIR for a semester or an academic year? And it's really sort of what you think fits your needs best. We have probably a little bit of a preference, in fact, for the academic year program because it does take a little bit of time for a scholar to acculturate when they get to the host campus. So maybe that means that things are a little bit slow in the very beginning. So maybe the scholar gets their feet under them a little more strongly in the second semester. So that's maybe a little bit of a bias on our part, a little built-in preference. But I think it's really up to you as to, you know, what you think is going to meet your needs best.
Great. Thanks, David. And that was actually one of the questions that came in, which I'm not sure if I don't think you saw that.
David has great insight.
Yeah. Okay.
Could I add just one thing? This is Darla. I really think that what David is mentioning, not only from a preference criteria, but also from an operational perspective, the year-long is really far preferable. Through other programs, we work with short, single semester scholars. But really, I think the great benefit of this is the relationships that are cultivated and then have the opportunity to bring forth fruit both on the ground while the scholar is in play on your campus, but also then it takes a little bit of time to work through some of these things, and if people have already left, that makes it kind of difficult. So I think that there's real momentum that can be built, and I think that I would strongly recommend that as well.
And then just to round this out, one other piece that you'd likely want to take into account is when you're looking at a named versus a recruited scholar. So sometimes grant length can come into play when we're actually confirming scholars and recruiting scholars. But again, that's something that we would be sure to be in contact with you about when the time comes. Now, Sarah.
All right. Well, please, again, keep submitting questions. We'll stay on just a couple minutes longer to get to them, but I'm going to talk about one last program that many of you might be familiar with and is a great addition to the Scholar in Residence program that everyone actually has mentioned throughout is the Outreach Lecturing Fund. So as Mamouna also participated in this, the Outreach Lecturing Fund is institutionally driven and will allow your institution to request current Fulbright scholars here in the U.S. So that any of the 850 core to the additional 36 SIR scholars, they're here for semesters for academic years, and you can actually apply to bring them for about 2 to 6 days, as they were discussing earlier. And this is an additional component that can really help to bolster not only your institution, but even your SIR application if you mention that this is something else that you are aware of and you want to ensure that the scholar you're hosting is participating in this and getting to other regions. So really the goal, there's no deadline for this. It's a rolling deadline. We just ask that you submit application forms, which is just a PDF, at least 1 month before the proposed lecture date. The goal with this one is to engage with those same institutions, your small liberal arts, your community colleges, your minority-serving institutions, so on and so forth. So this is another great opportunity to really help strategically on your campus. And with that, we are happy to answer any questions. This last page, again, has our email. If you need to contact David, it is there as well. He's more than happy to speak with you. Kaylee and I are are also very happy to bounce ideas. If you have questions, just give us a call, send us an email, we'll set up a time to speak with you. We're on all sorts of social media, so please engage with us for more opportunities. But we really want to encourage you to submit applications and questions if you do have them. And if you don't, we'll be by our emails and phones as well.
So it looks like we did receive a question beforehand. We had answered some about grant length and visa already. There was one, though, asking if there are any programmatic areas of focus for an institutional application to stand out. So apart from all of those components that we had spoken about throughout the presentation, I do want to mention discipline. So we do see applications falling within the realm of social sciences and humanities, yes, but we also do see them in any number of fields, the hard sciences, even art, dance, really any number of those creative fields also. So with those, we do just say to be cognizant of the proposal that you're setting forth. So again, a potential scholar would need to engage in teaching activity while on campus. So just make sure that person, whomever it may be or whom you're requesting to recruit, has that background that your individual institution needs in a teaching capacity, be it English language or just teaching experience in general.
Great. Thanks so much. We also have an additional question that came in. We're thankfully joined by a previous SIR host, and the question is, are they allowed to, having previously applied, apply again? Kaylee, do you want to start it off, and then we'll pass it to David?
Yeah, sure. So we have seen this happen in the past. We do ask that in the proposal that you take it into account and that you're sure to expand on how an additional SIR would impact your campus. So there are some pieces that you'll want to think of in terms of the application itself and that you can reach out to us to talk through. But David, I do want to actually pitch this over to you to get your insights on it.
Sure. So I think maybe a testament to the success of the program, we see a number of schools who have applied, have succeeded, had a good scholar in residence, and then apply again. A year later, 2 years later, 5 years later, that's fine. We appreciate the success you've had and the fact that you'd like to do it again. We do say the program, because it's relatively small, would likely give preference to schools that have had that have not had an SIR all that recently. So your chances perhaps are a bit diminished if you've had an SIR in 1 year and apply the following year immediately again. We also think that if you had an SIR and you had someone from a certain country, you might then want to think about, if you're applying again, think about someone else from a different country or a different region. Just as a way of broadening your internationalization efforts.
Okay, thank you so much, David. Okay.
All right, so just perusing, I think that about wraps it up in terms of questions. Again, I know we went over, thank you for being patient. If you have any additional questions, we're more than happy to answer them via email. I'm sure you have something specific for Darla, or Mimona, we're more than happy to forward that along to get their insight for you. But I really just want to take this time to thank our Mimona and Darla for being on this call, as well as David. We really appreciate having kind of this full kind of front for you to hear from. So thank you guys for being on today.
Our pleasure.
A pleasure.
And with that, we will wrap up this session. Thank you again for attending. We know you can do a lot with this past hour, but we are so glad to have you, and have a good rest of the afternoon. Bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye. Bye.